to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Maggie from San Diego.
Wow, there's a lot of people. I'm Maggie, I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for having me here. Hey, Summer. I wasn't supposed to be here tonight, or so I thought. At 7:25 tonight, my sponsor called me and said, "What are you doing tonight?" I said, "Right now I'm baking cookies." "Why?" She said, "Well, the speaker who was scheduled tonight had car problems. Can you get there?" So here I am. So usually when you're going to speak, you have time to think about it. And you have time to think about how you want to be, you know, portray yourself and how you're going to tell your story and how you want to look good. And I read the big book and I read the 12 and 12 and I get myself all ready. And I didn't do any of that tonight. So God's in charge. And I'm just going to tell you what it was like, what happened and what it's like now. And so I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up in a family of, Irish Catholic people. And everybody on my mother's side of the family drank heavily. And they were really well-educated and really smart people by day. And the minute you got, you know, drinking, they would become like crazy people who yelled at each other and threw punches and broke glasses, and it was terrifying for a child. I was afraid of them. My Uncle Ed was a big guy, like 6'3", and, you know, 200, and he terrified me because he would get really ugly. Both of my mother's parents quit drinking because they were alcoholics, but they just kind of suffered. My mother had three siblings, an aunt, a sister, and two brothers, and all of them had drinking problems. My aunt, though, had a full bar, and when I was about 13, and, you know, we were allowed to sip, we were encouraged to sip, but I never got drunk until, we weren't allowed to drink, until we were, you know, older. But at 13, I was at my aunt's house, and I knew I was going to summer camp the following week. I'd never been, you know, tried to drink in my life before, but I took a little bit out of every jar, every bottle. I didn't know the trick that you could put water in. I didn't know that, especially on the clear ones. You know, I didn't know that. She had a full bar. It had wines, elderberry wine, and it had schnapps, and it had tequila, and it had, you know, ouzo, and it had scotch, and I took a little out of every single one, and I filled up a 16-ounce Coke bottle, and I screwed a top back on, and I went to summer camp the following week. And the first night there, I drank alcoholically. I drank the whole thing. It tasted terrible, and mostly what I knew was that it tasted like scotch. I didn't know it was scotch at the time, but the next time I drank as a grown-up, and I smelled scotch, I knew I was not tasting that. But I didn't care. I knew it had magic in it, so I literally held my nose and drank as much of it down as I could. And I think I drank the whole thing because I really don't remember much of the night. I really don't. I do know that we were in this fancy church camp that had like dorms, like little dorms, and the girls were in these little things, and so I went in the bathroom and I did the drinking, and I immediately got sick. And I learned, I had long straight hair in those days, and I learned that if you don't pull your hair back, you throw up all over your hair as you're vomiting into the toilet. I learned all the important stuff for a woman, you know, drinking. I learned that if you lay down on the bed or on the cot and you put your foot out, the room might stop spinning for a little while. And I don't know how I got to sleep or, you know, what happened after that. I don't know. I was blacked out, and I was passed out. And that was it. And the next morning, I woke up, and I knew I'd do it again. There was something about it that I needed to do. And fast forward a year or so later, I have a boyfriend. And I know that he wants me to get loaded with him, smoke pot with him. And I know this is a meeting of AA, but I have a lot of drugs and alcohol, drugs and marijuana and stuff like that in my story. And because it was easier to get, but alcohol was always my drug of choice. And so I had an older sister who was already smoking, and I asked her to show me how, and she did. And that began this whole life of drinking to be with guys. I grew up in a church, and I grew up in a family that had, taught us that, there was right from wrong. I grew up in a family that expected us to do well in school, that expected us to be responsible, not to lie, to show up on time. And then when I was about 9, my parents divorced, and it changed. Everything changed. But I still had these values. I knew what was right. I'd been to church. I was in the choir. I had all these things that I knew were right. But the draw of my hormones and the alcohol was greater than all of those things. And so I started drinking in order to go to the drive-in and get in the back seat. And I started drinking to feel like I was pretty and smart and cute, especially to guys. I was really, really concerned about how boys felt about me. I had my first crush in kindergarten. I mean, I was terrible. I was boy crazy from the time I was a little girl. I chased boys on the playground. I was one of those who ran after them and tried to kiss them. That's a character defect that went away when I got sober. I will tell you. I'm serious. It's the one thing that is the only character defect in my life that when I turned it over, when I got sober, it went away 100%. I didn't sleep with other people's husbands. I didn't chase other men. I didn't cheat on my boyfriend at the time. But I had it even before I started drinking. I knew when I went to elementary school that something was different about me. I would go into class, and I felt like the other kids had parents who'd gotten a book. And those parents had read the book and told their kids what to expect in school. And my parents either didn't go to the meeting, didn't read the book, or didn't tell me. And I always felt like other kids knew something I didn't know, and I was always playing catch-up trying to figure out, how do you know that? How do you know how to fit in? How do you know we're going to have recess next? I just was always baffled, and I always felt like I was trying to catch up. So, I also belonged to a church. I was in the choir. I loved to sing, and I loved church. I loved the youth group. I loved everything about it. But when I started, getting in the back seat of the car with a boy and, fighting off the, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll do this, but not that. I knew that that was something that in my church would send me to hell. I just knew it. So I started thinking about, I got these grandiose ideas about how much I knew, and I started to doubt that there might really be a God, and maybe this whole nonsense about, going to hell was nonsense. And by the time I was 17, I had decided that I didn't believe in God, that he didn't exist. How could he exist? Life sucked. And so when I was... So my parents divorced my... I haven't even gotten out of my teenage years. Lucky for you, I got sober at 23, so I don't have a lot to tell you. Okay. Yeah, because the next few years were terrible. When I was 17, I had an older sister who had been drinking and drugging, and she had a nervous breakdown. She had a mental departure from reality, and she got committed to an institution. And while she was there, and all of it was drug and alcohol related, it triggered something. She was doing a lot of hallucinogenics, and there's a lot of mental illness in my family, especially on my dad's, that part of the family. My dad had it. That's why my parents divorced. My mother was very kind about that. She always said, your dad's just sick, but we can't live with him. And unfortunately, they didn't have the kind of help for people with mental illness that they do today through medication. He tried a few things, but basically made him an idiot. That's how he felt. He thought it made him dull and not very quick-witted, and he wouldn't take him. So my mother couldn't deal with him, and that's how they why they got divorced. But she was always very kind. Your father is sick. He loves us all, but we can't live with him. So whatever it was my sister was doing, it triggered something in her. She had this mental break, and she had to be committed to an institution. And back then, there wasn't the kind of, this is 1973, 74. We didn't have SSRIs and, you know, rehabs like we have today. There wasn't this awareness of dual diagnosis or any of that nonsense. They put her in a locked ward with other juveniles. She was 20 years old. She was considered a juvenile by the state, and she was there for 8, 9 months, and at Christmas time, they were going to let her come for a visit. And about a week before Christmas, she decided to leave the grounds with two other patients, two boys, two men, young men. And they're 15. And they got into an argument, and they beat her to death. And I know that sounds very graphic, but it's part of my story, and it's one of the reasons I'm here today. I'm sober today because I didn't think that would happen to me. Fast forward, I'm drinking, I'm drugging daily. By 17, 18 years old, I am, you know, going down the hill behind the school at lunchtime, getting high, drinking every day that I can. And when I went off to college, you know, this is game on. You can drink anytime, you know. You can go between classes and all of that. So I am desperately, oh, I forgot. In there somewhere I got married at 17. I'm not kidding. I got married. I was like 17 years old. My story, you know. So I got sober in 1980. I have now been alive and sober longer. 38 years. It'll be 39 in August. I was 23 when I got here. That part of my story is a lot shorter, but it's the most important in some ways. So anyway, I did marry this guy because I wanted to sleep with him. I slept with him. It wasn't all I thought it was going to be. and that didn't change until I got sober. But anyway, after that, I was sleeping with people I didn't know. I was waking up in places I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where my car was. I didn't know how to find a way to get home. I would wake up and I'd be like, "Do I know your name?" I wouldn't, you know. I'd wake up with women I didn't know. I'd be at their houses. I'd be like, "There's a story in the Big Book that talks about this woman wakes up, comes out of a blackout, and she's with a group with another woman." And I so identify with that, to just wake up. I mean, I'm 20 years old, and I'm waking up in the middle of, you know, something and going, "Who are you?" And then trying to piece together and asking him, "What was your name again? Oh, did Beth introduce me to you? Okay, I think I remember." It was awful. So at 20, when I'm 21, my mother is drinking all this time as well, and my mother gets sober when I'm 21 years old. And she is living in California by the time I'm 22. She's living in Poway. And right before she gets sober, my older brother commits suicide under the influence of drugs and alcohol. So he's 6 years older than me, my sister's 5 years older than me, and they've both died. And my mother gets sober. And I'm dating a guy who is just gotten out of prison for dealing drugs. And he's starting to smack me around. And I've graduated from college. You know, I'm trying to... It was a mess. I'm going to work, but I'm getting loaded in the car on the way, you know. And I'm teaching middle school music. You know what it's like to be with a group of 14-year-olds? When you're sober, it's craziness. And when you're stoned, you're like, "Oh, my God." I knew they knew. I felt like some of them knew. But anyway, so that's what my life was like. It was just a... So this guy smacked me around. I call my mother, and I tell her the story. And she goes, you get on a plane tomorrow, and you come to San Diego. I'll put a ticket at the counter. And I said, okay. And that was like the end of July, 1980. And my mother lives in Poway, and in 1980, Poway had two roads in and out, you know. And they rolled up the streets at night, except for Sambo's, which was a little restaurant like a Denny's, and my mother's friends who went to meetings. And meetings in those days started at 8 or 8:30 at night. And they went out for coffee afterwards. And then people would eat. And so, you know, I'm here in California, and I don't know a soul yet. But you want to come to the meeting? We're going to go out to eat afterwards. So I'd go to the meeting. And I'd seen her take cakes before at home, and I loved you people. I knew you had it designed for living that would work, and it would work for me if I just didn't have to do God. That was my problem. I liked the idea of the 12 steps and all that, if you could just do them without God. So I would go to meetings, and then we'd go out afterwards, and the people were so nice to me, and I knew you were my people. I loved being here. But I felt like, and I always say it this way, I don't know if you were a kid and you had an older brother or sister tried to take you through a doorway, and you would just stick your arms and your legs in the jam and just like this. That's how I felt I was doing with you guys. You were sucking me in, and I was like, no, 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 no. Well, within 3 weeks, I find a dealer. I'm sleeping with men I don't know. I'm borrowing her car and driving from Poway to Balboa Park, where the skaters were. In 1980, there was a big skate scene in San Diego. And I'm skating down there, and I'm meeting people, and I'm getting loaded. And one night, I'm going to maybe two meetings a week with her because I'm desperate to get out on the nights that she doesn't. You know, when she doesn't let me have the car, and or she can't get a ride. She went to a meeting every single day. She'd only been sober herself about 18 months. She went to a meeting every single day. And so they used to go to this Saturday night meeting up in Santa Isabel. I think it's still there. It was August 23rd, 1980. And I'd been to it one other time with her. I mean, I'd only been here 3 weeks. But I'd been to it. She went with a group of friends. I mean, I look back now and I realize my mother was 50-something years old at the time, which I'm now older than that. But her friends were all in their 50s, and they treated me like I was one of the kids, and they just brought me along, and there were four or five of them. They'd go up in this Volkswagen bus, and it was an open-ended meeting, and it started like at 8 or 8:30, and some nights we wouldn't get home till like 11:30. Everybody shared. It was a candlelight meeting. It was in a barn behind the store. And one night, the second night I went to that meeting, August 23rd, 1980, I heard my story. And it wasn't, I'm 23 and I'm a young woman and I'm sleeping around and I'm drinking and drugging. No, it was like a 40-year-old man who talked about his drinking and how he knew it was killing him and it was holding him back. And that every time he took one step forward, drugs and alcohol would drag him back. And I knew he was telling the truth. And I knew in that moment that I was dying, that I was going to wake up. I was not going to wake up one of those times in some strange man's house. He was going to kill me. I was going to be in a car accident. I was going to commit suicide like my brother, or some guy who was pissed off at me was going to beat me to death. Because I did things to men that, you know, I wanted your attention desperately. But when you weren't looking, if you were sleeping and snoring, I would steal money out of your wallet, you know. I stole from employers. I did all kinds of things I knew were wrong, and I knew my soul was dying, and I knew it. And I couldn't deny it. I knew I belonged here. And the light in the room literally got smaller and smaller until I felt like it was a pinpoint. And I knew, you do something tonight, or else. And I remember that moment like it was yesterday. I practice remembering that moment like it was yesterday because it's the most important moment in my life. Because I walked out of that meeting and I said to my mother, I think I might be an alcoholic and I belong here. And she looked at me, she said, Really? She had no idea. And she said, and then after she got over that, she put her arms around me and said, welcome. And she told her friends, and they put their arms around me, and they said, great, let's go get ice cream or, you know, whatever. And I went to a meeting every day for the next year. And okay. Now, that was the first, that was my moment of clarity, and that was my surrender. And I went to a meeting every day, and there was a woman named Vera, and her husband's name was Harold, and they lived in Ramona, and she was 16 years sober. She was in her 60s, and she was like a goddess to me, you know, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, okay. And I said, because I really want to work the steps. And she said, okay. So the next time I saw her, she said, here's my number, give me a call. I didn't call her because I saw her the next night at the meeting, because she went to all the meetings I went to. And I said, I really want to work the steps. And she said, okay, well, do you think you're an alcoholic? And I said, oh, yeah, no doubt about it. She goes, is your life unmanageable? I said, oh, for sure. She said, by now, well, so I forget to tell you these things. So one of the things I had to come to terms with was the whole God thing. I know I need this program, and I am, like, I'm hanging on to being an atheist because it's, I just can't make sense of the God that I thought I had been taught about. No one had taught me about any other kind. And then I met you guys. And one of the things I learned is that there's power in this room and that I could fake it till I make it. And then I could use the group as my power greater than myself. And I did some, you know, church searching. I went to churches during my first year of sobriety and tried to see if I'd fit in. And I'd feel like I don't belong here, but I'd walk into an AA meeting and I'd think, this is where I belong. There was a guy in Poway back then whose name was Gene C., and he was a crotchety old guy, and he was mean, and he was one of those people that would say, you know, those steps are ordered for a reason, and if you read how it works and didn't say the numbers beforehand, when you got done, he'd go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, you know, like that. And I was terrified of him. But he also said something which I still say today. If you're having trouble making contact with a power greater than yourself, go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because God goes to every single one. And I knew that to be true. I felt it when I walked in the rooms. I felt your love. I felt your support. And best of all, the day after I decided to join, I didn't drink. And 30 days later, I hadn't drank. And 90 days later, I hadn't drank. And I'm like, this is miraculous. The power is in here. This is all I need. And I have searched over the years for other spiritual solutions. I have, but I always come here. This is my solution. It's why I still go to meetings today. So here I am with Vera. We're literally standing outside of a Friday night meeting. And we're talking, and she's, and I want to work the steps. And I'm like, what do I have to do? And she asked me these questions. You believe you're an alcoholic? Yes. Life is unmanageable? Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure. Have you come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore your sanity? I said, yeah, I haven't drank. I haven't drank, at that point, it was like 45 days. I haven't had a drink in 45 days. I haven't even wanted to. I couldn't do that before. I could not go, you know, to the next day. I always drank every single day. And so I never even wanted to try to quit. It was the answer. It filled that hole that said I didn't fit in and other kids' parents got a, you know, got a book. With the alcohol, I had the book. That's how I felt. Except I couldn't remember in the morning because I didn't remember where I'd been. So then she said, have you made a decision to turn your will and your life over to care of God as you understand? And I said, yeah, I'm in this AA thing. And she said, good, write your inventory. That is how I worked the first three steps the first time. And I was stunned. I was like, okay. Now, I was going to a big book study because my mother went to one. She went to a 12 and 12 study, a big book study, and there was a beginner's meeting in Rancho Bernardo, and she went to all of them. And so I had a lot of exposure to the book, and so I started thinking I would write my inventory, and eventually I couldn't figure out, I would think of stuff while I got in a little job and I think about things while I was at work. But I come home at night and I couldn't think of it. I couldn't remember, what was that thing I wanted? Oh yeah, I did that. What was that? You know, and I wanted to write down the things like lying to people that I had done, stealing from people that I had done, you know, cheating on people, you know, all of those kinds of moral inventory. I didn't really look at my character defects. I didn't look at resentments in that first inventory. I was 23. I didn't even know what resentment was yet. So, but I wrote all that stuff. I couldn't remember it. So what I finally figured out is that I would take a little pad of paper with me to work. I put it in my pocket. And when I would think of something, I would write the name of the person, Brian, put it in my pocket. And when I got home that night, I could remember, oh, that's right, I wanted to write about what I did to Brian. Or, you know, this guy or that woman or, you know. And so that's how, and that's what I did. I just basically, then I would write about it and I would write up just as much as I could on that subject and I'd go to bed. So I don't know how long it took me, but a couple months I took it to her house and I shared it with her. And I was nervous. You know, I'd done things that I was very ashamed of, and I didn't think she'd understand. Well, now that I'm her age and I've been around a while, I understand that she completely understood. But at that time, I knew she said she'd understood, but I didn't know until I told her, and she put her arms around me and said, it's okay. And, you know, my mom was in the program, and she asked about my relationship, and by now I am, like, so grateful to my mother that she's put up with me all these years and that she's given me a place to live and all of that. I didn't have any problems with her. That didn't come till year 8. And she asked me about my father, and she said, how do you feel about your father? And I said, I don't have any feelings about him. My mother always said he was sick, and she said, can you forgive him? And I said, for what? And she said, for not being there for you. And I never realized that I had any feelings about it at all. And I said, oh, I can work on that. So that's what I did. I did my amends. You know, I worked the 12 steps in my first year, and I'm very grateful for that. I had a sponsor who didn't push me. She never called me. She never told me to call, but I did see her. I probably saw her 5 times a week at meetings. Plus, I lived with my mother, who was in the program, and I went to, you know, lots of meetings. My life started to get better. You know, the outside stuff that is screwed up when you get here from being dishonest, from being, you know, from not being responsible. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a driver's license. I didn't have insurance, any of those things. I remember when I got my first insurance on a car, and I was just like, I'm a real grown-up now, you know? I felt so grown up. I remember when I voted the first time, and I wore that sticker, I voted around. I'm a grown-up. I have no idea who I voted for, and I didn't know I didn't know 20 minutes after I voted who I'd voted for, but I knew I'd voted, and I decided I wanted to act like a grown-up. So, thank you. So, eventually I meet my husband, who I've now been married to 35 years. I had kids with that man. My kids are in their 30s now. They've never seen me drink. I went to meetings all through their childhood. My kids knew that AA always came first. And so it's, I sponsor. Nobody asked me to speak or sponsor until I had 10 years of sobriety. And even the ones who asked me at 10 years to sponsor them didn't call me. I was so convinced I was so full of ego. I was convinced I'd be a great sponsor and a great speaker, and nobody called. And I was just like, they don't know what they're missing. I don't know. On the other hand, I knew enough to know that God was in charge. I did have a profound relationship with this power that I feel when I walk into a meeting of AA. I traveled for a while, for quite a few years, and I could go anywhere. I've been to Chicago, I've been to Texas, I've been to Washington, D.C., I've been to New York, I've been all over California, all over the... First thing I do when I get to town is I look up AA, and if I can, I call their central office and say, you know, do you guys give rides? Because a lot of times I won't have a car. I'll have come there in a shuttle with other people or whatever. And, you know, it's really funny when you're at a company function and the one free night, you go somewhere. And people go, how do you know? You know somebody in every town. Oh, yeah, my mother has a lot of friends. Well, you know, my mom was in AA. It was the truth, you know. So anyway, six months after I got sober, my sister, who's a year younger than me, decided to get sober as well. And this December, she'll have 39 years. She's got, you know, she met her husband. He's seen her drink. But her kids never did. They went to high school together. So anyway, fast forward to, you know, my son ended up having a drug problem, and I had to learn to go to Al-Anon in order to deal with that. And he's clean today, and I stay out of his business. I love his granddaughter, I love his wife, and I love him, but I don't ask, are you okay? Are you going to meetings? It's none of my business. As long as his behavior is acceptable to me, and he's welcome in my house. About a year and a half ago, well, it was January 31st of 2018. I retired in 2015. My husband, who's significantly older than I am, had a stroke. And 3 days later, he had another one. And 3 days later, in 10 days, he had three strokes. And it was like, you know, I thought I could manage. And he's very different than he was. And in some ways, that's better. In some ways, it's worse. But I was angry. I was so angry. I was angry at him. I was angry at the situation. I was angry at myself for not seeing it coming and leaving him sooner. That thought crossed my mind. I should have left him last year. You know, we weren't getting along beforehand, and by the way, my husband always gets better when I go to more meetings. That's a truth. If you're having trouble in a relationship, go to more meetings. It always helps. And I've known that. And as a matter of fact, he'll even say to me, don't you think you should go to a meeting? although tonight he was disappointed because I did make cookies, and they're his favorite. And he was like, you're not going to be here for the cookies? No, honey, you're going to have to eat them by yourself. Oh, okay. I can eat them while you're not here? He's a little bit childlike now. Anyway, I have worked the last year on accepting that I have no control over what happened to him. I had to get counseling. I have a social worker of my own. I go to more meetings. And I had to finally accept that, you know, this was God's will for him and that I had to take care of me. And so it took me a while. About 4 or 5 months ago, I really started doing more for myself. I joined a choir because I love to sing. I started exercising again. I try to go out for dinner with girlfriends. I read more books. I don't read any books that teach me anything anymore, except for the big book and AA books. I read books for fun only. So I try to do things that make me happy. And it's amazing when I accept that he's the way he's supposed to be and there's nothing I can do to change him, but I work on myself, I love him again. It's an amazing thing. And now, around October, I thought to myself, for the rest of my life, I'm going to have to live with this guy who can't drive. This is a man who, 10 days before his stroke, he turned 77. He took his car, he rode out to Borrego Springs, he rode his bicycle 77 miles around Borrego Springs, drove into Carly's, got a burger, and rode home, in the car. And 10 days later, he can't be left alone, you know, and he can't remember his name half the time. And that's changed, I have to say. He's gotten a lot of help, and it's gotten better. But I thought it had happened to me. And I was resentful, and I was angry. And I had a moment, the only moment in my entire sobriety, where I thought to myself, if it's going to keep being like this, I can see why people drink. And that scared the shit out of me. That's the only time in my sobriety. I've had both my parents die. I've had sit, blah, blah, blah. That scared me. And I went, I better go to more meetings. And then I had to start telling the truth that I was angry, and I was angry at him, and it wasn't his fault. And I felt bad that I was angry at him. But I had to tell people. I had to tell the truth. I wanted to look good. Because when you have 38 years of sobriety, you want people to think you've got it together. I don't have it together. I have it together enough to come here, so you'll keep me together. And so I have, I have a regular daily, 2 minutes left, maybe? One? I have a daily routine. I get up in the morning and I read something spiritual. Right now, my kick is The Grapevine. I read The Grapevine. If I run out of pages, there's, only so many stories in The Grapevine, and I read them. And then if the month is longer than The Grapevine provides, I read Living Sober. Living Sober came out in like 1960, 70 something. And somebody gave it to me when I was new. And I used to read it a lot. It has a lot of cool ideas that still are pertinent to my life today, 9 years later, that tell me how to get through a day without drinking, and I can start my day off with those ideas. So I do that, and then I spend a few quiet minutes praying, being grateful, thanking God for my sobriety and for my serenity, and then I ask for the respect and compassion for other people, especially for my husband, that they deserve. And then I sit there quietly and just wait until I know I'm done, which I guess is meditation. But I don't call it that because when I really meditate, I start thinking too much. I have to get quiet. If I think I'm going to meditate, then I start thinking about what I'm going to meditate about. So I have to keep it really simple. So I sponsor several women. Actually, I sponsor a lot of women. I've had women that I've been sponsoring now for over 20 years, and that is such a gift. And I have a sponsor. That's who called me tonight and said, they need a speaker. Will you go down? I'm like, yeah, I guess. and then I thought, what? It's like getting a call. If you want to have a real profound feeling about why you're here, sign yourself up for the noon to 6 a.m. shift to take calls from central office. Because when that phone rings at 1 a.m., you go, who the hell is calling me? And then you look and it's AASD. That's what's in my phone. I think, oh my God, God is calling me to remind me that I need to give this away. So I'm still of service. Unfortunately, I was answering phones and I was a GSR and I was taking a commitment into Las Colinas before the strokes, but I had to say, this is not the time to be doing that. So he's home. I have a neighbor looking in on him, but he can be home alone now for 3 or 4 hours by himself, and I don't worry he'll blow up the house or he'll fall and break a hip. But I have no idea what I just babbled about, but I will tell you that one of the things I do regularly is I remind myself what that night felt like, that moment of clarity when I knew I was dying. And I remind myself of that maybe once every couple weeks, and I feel it in my body and my soul. I remember it. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I think maybe that's why I'm still sober, is that I keep that memory alive. I feel it. I nurture it. I remember it. It's so important to remember where I came from, how bad it really was, and how great it is to be sober. Oh, my God, I am so grateful that you guys were here, and you're always here for me, no matter where I go. I've been to meetings in Italy. I've been to meetings in England. I have a daughter who travels all over. Thanks for letting me share, and thanks for letting me substitute.